This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. I have the air blowing on me, but you know, it's not doing much good. Sadness, there is sadness. Up to this point, I've been able to, and I'm actually backing my car out of the parking lot here because I'm not leaving from work. I'm leaving from the retirement center where my mom and dad are because we're making plans for tomorrow. More on that in a minute. Up to this point with my little buggy, I've been able to charge the air conditioning and then have that charge last for, a month, 2 months. There is sadness. I charged my air conditioning and it didn't really ever last more than about a week. Oh, there is sadness. But it's already mid-June. And that means I just have two of the hottest months of the year to get through. And if I can get through those 2 months, then it'll start cooling off. And then I'll have my little car back. So my wife is telling me it's time for me to get another car. But, you know, this is such a great little car. And it's paid for. And it gets 30 miles to the gallon. And the next car, I really want to be an electric car, little electric pod car, but I want it to have like 300 miles worth of range, rechargeable in 2 hours on a standard 12-gauge extension cord, full automation, full navigation, you know, voice recognition, the whole bit, fully connected, blah, 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 blah. That's what I want. I just want a little pod I can get in, tell it where I want to go, and it just takes me there. That's what I want. And we're not quite there yet. You know, another couple of years, maybe 3-4 years, we are close. We are close. We can make this work. The technological gurus can make this work. So I just really kind of hate to invest in some kind of a little gas car now, when I can drive this car. What it does mean is that it may be a little warm, like it is today. Today is really, as I recall, one of the first it's summer days. So it was toasty when I came out today. It's 89, got some humidity working, so, and the car was closed up. So, you know, it's good. Anyways, it'll be fine. It was a good week at work. We had a good week launching the paperless, our first paperless form seemed to be going fine. We actually got some input in and they worked their way around and did a few things and got some things done. And it was good. Step at a time. Some stuff has actually been approved and accepted and ready to go. So we're going to have some stuff to compile at the end of the month. That's good. Wrote a little reminder email to people today, said, hey, we're out here, because we've got 10 of our associates that are on this test, and we've heard from two of them, so that's not too bad. First couple of days, 20% participation rate, and we're going to hear from more of them, hopefully. Oh, you know what? I shouldn't be going down this road. I should be going down another road. Okay, yeah. I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that not only did the road department, take out the bridge that I used going home, they also started doing chip and seal on a big main stretch of road that gets me there. So I was having a little detour, and then when the detour was over, there was a lot of from the road noise. Well, now they're doing the rest of the stretch of road. They're in process with that. So I'm having to take a detour around up a road called 159, Farm Road 159. It does extend the drive a little bit, but since I'm leaving from the retirement village, it doesn't extend it that much. In fact, I'll still probably be home a little sooner than I would normally be. So, anyways, work is well, all is well, things are puttering along, we're getting things done, that's the important part. As far as family goes, we are at the next stage in the saga. My mom did break her hip several weeks ago. She has not really been responding to physical therapy. At this point, even before she broke her hip, she was at the point where she just really wanted to sleep. You know, she just wanted to sleep because she has medium stage dementia. And you get to that stage. So because of that, the insurance is finishing up. And so now we're going to have to transition her into long-term care. And so we're moving through all those steps at this point, and we're seeing how to preserve as many resources as we can. And, you know, how do we do this? How do we do that? But we're moving through all that, and it's going to be fine. There is this thing called division of assets that I just found out about a couple of days ago, and it was specifically designed for this situation where you have someone who's still mainly independent, but at the same time is married to someone who's going into a nursing facility. And it is a way to protect at least half of the assets. It's perfectly legal, designed by the government to do this. A way to protect at least half of the assets for the individual who is not going into the nursing home. So we'll be able to do that, sit down. The nursing home said they could walk us through all those steps to get all the paperwork filed. And that way we'll split it up and take half of their savings and move it apart and give mom still. It's going to be a little over $6,000 a month. By the time we get half of it carved off for mom, you know, we'll be somewhere in the range of being able to pay for 6 months before we have to file for Medicare, Medicaid, and have the government kind of take over that load. But then that will leave about 6 months worth of help for dad for when he gets closer to this point. And, you know, so it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. We'll have to file some paperwork and find out who needs what, blah, 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 blah. But we'll work all those things step at a time and move things through and, you know, do what we need to do. I think now we're going to arrange for my dad to go down to have lunch with my mom every day. So there's already a bus that goes around the retirement center and picks up the people who have a meal plan. And, you know, I'm in the process of talking to my dad about that and getting a little pushback from him because, you know, he's saying, well, I like the food that I make, because he can still make his own food. But I'm trying to encourage him from the angle of, yes, Pop, but Mom isn't here. This gives you a chance to get out of the house every day, go down and see Mom, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll see. I'm sure we're going to get that worked out as well. So all is well there. As far as the writing goes, all is well. I've been a little slowed down with all these extra preparations in terms of the editing, but we're just going to keep editing as much as we can edit, and then when the time comes to say, well, that's done with the editing, we'll just be done, which I expect to happen sometime on Sunday. I expect to be finished with the editing so I can start my read-through of book 6. That should take about a week, my final read-through, final dust-up, and then the last week of June, I'm going to be going through and making corrections to the final cover and setting up all the files and getting the Kindle version going and getting the EPUB version going. But I've done that before. We're going to be fine there. And then it is back to book 7 and trying to figure out exactly how the book is supposed to end. I'm halfway through. I have some options, but I don't quite know what's going on there. But that's okay. It's all part of the adventure. I've just been, over the last several weeks, I've mentioned it on the podcast a couple of times, I've been watching a lot of videos on the coming wave of AI, deep learning, job replacement, all that kind of stuff, because I do find it fascinating. These next 5 years, 8 years, 10 years are going to be fascinating. With all the things that are seemingly coming together at the same time, it's going to be very, very interesting. I was watching a TED Talk called Three Principles for Creating Safer AI. This was by Stuart Russell, and I think it was a valiant attempt to try to figure out how to do this. It remains to be seen whether or not this was a valiant, futile attempt, or whether or not he's onto something that can actually be done. But it was interesting. You know, he started by going through the standard kind of AI stuff. He did show a picture of Lee Sedol, who is one of the world's greatest Go players, playing against AlphaGo, I think was the name of the computer, and staring at the moves that AlphaGo is making. And you can see, in Ozarkian terms, the boy is just gobsmacked. I mean, he just can't believe how well this computer is playing. And Stuart Russell talked about, he's having that holy cow moment when people realize that AI is actually progressing a lot faster than we expected. And he went on to talk about how that, I think it was one of the other speakers at the TED conference, had said that while machines are reading, they're not really understanding what they're reading, at least not yet. But he said, you know, that's going to happen very soon. And afterwards, in very short order, machines will have read everything that the human race has ever written. And he said, when you see that happening, that ability will enable machines, along with the ability to look farther than humans can, as we've already seen in Go, to have access to more information. They will be able to make better decisions, etc., etc., etc. So, of course, the question is this a good thing? And obviously, there are people who think it's not, like Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking. They're urging caution. And then some people, he pointed out, were just saying, well, just make sure you can turn off the power. You know, just make sure that we still can do that. But he said, obviously, there's this queasy feeling of making something smarter than your own species is maybe not a good idea. But he said, in his opinion, it's probably unstoppable at this point. Someone is going to do this because there is such a strong economic incentive to do it. He said it's interesting because this idea of thinking about this potential isn't new. He quoted a man as saying, we had better be sure that the purpose we put into the machine is the purpose we really desire. And he said that was Norbert Wiener from 1960. After he watched early learning systems learn to play checkers better than the creators. You know, he also had a quote from Turing about, you know, basically the same type of thing, and illustrating this idea of we better be sure of what we want to tell the machine to do. He said this goes back a long way. He said, you know, all the way back to like the legends of King Midas. King Midas thought he knew
what he wanted to do. I want everything I touch to turn to gold. Which, of course, the tale of King Midas gives us pause, because then all his food turned to gold and his relatives turned to gold. And he died surrounded by wealth, but not in a situation that anyone would want to be. He said, he said putting that wrong objective is only part of the problem. He said there's another part. If you put an objective into a machine, even something as simple as fetch the coffee, says, well, the machine says to itself, well, how might I fail to fetch the coffee? Perhaps someone will want to switch me off. Okay, I have to take steps to prevent that. I will disable my off switch. I will do anything to defend myself against interference with this objective. And his point was, obviously, that if you give a machine a single-minded pursuit, it will spray out in all sorts of ways that you don't predict. He said, so what he's been trying to do is trying to figure out how do we redefine AI to get away from this classical notion of machines that intelligently pursue objectives. And in his mind, you have to get three principles right. By the way, I'm on the chip and seal now, which is why there's more road noise, and now I'm moving off of it. Said the first one is altruism. He said, if you like that the robot's only objective is to maximize the realization of human objectives, of human values. Okay, we'll just go with that. That's even possible. And he said, by values here, I don't just mean touchy-feely, goody-goody values. I mean whatever it is that the humans would prefer their life to be like. So this actually violates Asimov's law that the robot has to protect its own existence. In his opinion, the robot should have no interest in preserving its own existence at all. So he wants to build that into the robot. The next thing that he wants to build into the robots is the idea of humility. So, as it turns out, I'm rolling down my window because I'm going to wave at my neighbor as I go by. They're out mowing lawn. He said, it turns out really to be really important to make robots safe. It says that the robot does not know what those human values are. So the first thing you tell the robot is, you need to focus exclusively on human values. And then you tell the robot, but you don't know what those are. So the robot is in a constant state of questioning whether it really understands what the human values are. Now he says, of course, in order to be useful to us, the robot has to have some idea of what we want. And he said it will obtain that information primarily from observing human choices. He recognizes that this observation could be fraught with peril, but he's hopeful. He's hopeful. So our choices reveal information about what is the preferred lives that we want, how we want our lives to be. So there, those are the three principles. I missed a principle. The second law and principle, blah, 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 blah. Second law, first law is altruism. Second one is humility. Where's the third principle? Anyways, okay, so there's three principles in there somewhere. He says, let's see how this applies to the question of, can you switch the machine off, as Turing suggests. He says, so here's this PR2 robot. This is the one we have in our lab. It has a big red off switch on the back. The question is it going to let you switch it off? If we do it in the classical way, we give it the objective, fetch the coffee. And the robot says, I must fetch the coffee. I must fetch the coffee until I'm dead. So obviously the PR2 has been listening to my talk. And so it says, therefore,
I must disable my off switch and probably taser all the other people in Starbucks who might interfere with me. This is not what you want. Okay. So what happens if the machine is uncertain about its objective? One moment, I'm back in my garage. Okay, so he says, what happens if the machine is uncertain about this objective? Does that improve things? Okay, it says the machine, okay, the human might switch me off, but only if I'm doing something wrong. Well, I don't really know what is wrong, but I know what I don't want it to do. So there's the first and second principles. So I should let the human switch me off. And in fact, you can calculate the incentive that the robot has to allow the human to switch it off, and it's directly tied to the degree of uncertainty about the underlying objective. Okay. So it learns something, and then when the machine is switched off, that third principle comes into play. It learns something about the objectives it should be pursuing because it learns what it did wasn't right. Okay, so the first one is altruism, and then the second one is humility, and then the third one apparently is how do you learn what is right? You have to learn it from observation. Okay, so he said, now this third principle, you're probably scratching your head about that. You're thinking, well, you know, I behave badly. I don't want my robot to behave like me. I sneak down in the middle of the night and take stuff from the fridge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's all kinds of things you don't want the robot doing, but in fact, it doesn't quite work that way. Just because you behave badly doesn't mean the robot is going to copy your behavior. Yeah, tell that to every child who's ever been born. It's going to understand your motivations and help you resist them if appropriate. But it's still difficult. What we're trying to do, in fact, is to allow machines to predict for any person and any possible life they could live and the lives of everyone else, which would they prefer? Okay, that seems doable. Then there are many, many difficulties involved with this. I don't expect this is going to get solved very quickly. The real difficulties, in fact, are us. Yes, they are. As I've already mentioned, we behave badly. In fact, some of us are downright nasty. Now, the robot, as I said, doesn't have to copy this behavior. The robot does not have the objective on its own. It's purely altruistic, and it's not designed just to satisfy the desires of one person, the user, but in fact, it's getting hot in the garage. I'm going to open the garage door so we get a little more air. But in fact, it has to respect the preferences of everybody. So it can deal with a certain amount of nastiness, and it can even understand your nastiness, for example, if you take bribes as a passport official because you need to feed your family and send your kids to school. It can understand that it doesn't mean it's going to steal. In fact, it'll just help you send your kids to school. Wow. Okay. So then he gives some examples of how things could go wrong, like, you know, you're talking to Siri, and it's Siri on steroids, and it says, listen, your wife called to remind you about dinner tonight, and you say, what dinner tonight? And she says, well, it's your 20th anniversary, Siri does. And I can't do that. I have to meet with the Secretary General tonight. Oh, that's okay. I warned you about that, but you overrode my recommendation. Well, what am I going to do? I can't just tell him I'm busy. Don't worry. I arranged for his plane to be delayed. So this goes on, and he talks about this, and he says, you know, there's a very strong incentive to get this right because we don't want the robot cooking the cat because there's no food in the house, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea here is that we instill robots with this idea of uncertainty that they themselves are going to solve by looking at our behaviors. And frankly, what all of this sounds like is that we are trying to create God because we don't necessarily want to replicate who we are in terms of this AI because we already recognize that probably wouldn't be good. But instead, what we're going to do is we make this altruistic, benevolent force that is just going to somehow force us to be good or force us to behave or force us or manipulate us into becoming what we should have been all along and making our lives better. And it just seems to me that first of all, that is a tall order. And second of all, it seems to me that we have had engines of society that have been trying to make that formula work for thousands of years. And it ain't worked out very well. There's still wars, there's still this, there's still the other. So, you know, if you're actually going to develop an AI that has the capability to make the kind of updates and changes that this is talking about making, given it that kind of power, and then you're going to make it uncertain on top of that, you either are not going to make it uncertain enough, and it's going to do things like cooking the cat for dinner, or you're going to make it too uncertain, and it's just going to sit there and spin in its uncertainties and not do anything. Because as I've said before, creating an intelligent system that is actually sane, I think, is going to be the big challenge. And I don't think we appreciate just how hard that is and just how much active influence that takes from God to keep the entire human race from going off the rails. And that's why Jesus talks to everyone all the time and keeps whispering to them, because that's the only way in our present situation with our balance between flesh and spirit that we can keep the world from going off the rails. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.